really, today's kind of question is, how does planning deregulation impact on neighborhoods? We're going to be looking at this from two different perspectives, and we've got three people here to talk to us about that. One will be the partial deregulation that happened around short-term letting. We've got my colleague, Alessandra Rossa, who she and I have done some research on this. We've got Gary Battle from Camden, who has been at the very sharp end of all of this for some while, hence the feeling of, oh God. And then we've also got Ben Clifford, who will be talking to us about the recent changes in permitted development rights, specifically the office to resi conversions. So we'll start off, and Alessandra, you can start off talking, and then we'll move on to Gary, and then to Ben, and then we'll have time for questions for everyone. Okay?
Okay. So the regulation is often presented like a panacea for helping the increase of housing supply and give individuals the freedom to extract value from their properties. And in our research, we asked a variety of planning officers if letting the market decide was actually desirable and necessary, and what was the impact at the local level. So we examined this question through the use of two case studies, the extension of permitted development rights, Ben has been talked about later, and the partial deregulation of short-term letting in London that allowed the residents to rent out the part or whole of their property up to 90 nights per calendar year. So the Regulation Act has been introduced in 2015, and according to the planning officer we interviewed, has contributed to spread out short-term letting, at least in inner London. So there are entire blocks of flats in properties that have been used exclusively for the purpose of short-term letting, and even if there is a law that limits the number of nights that you can rent out your property, is almost impossible for local authorities to enforce it and police it. So I have even followed an enforcement team at Westminster. They have to cross information from a look at their website, try to count the number of reviews, try to see which properties are likely to be rented out for more than 90 days, so then have a look at the pictures and try to identify the flats, then start the doorstep inspection, so they have to go over again, knock the doors, and try to gather evidence in order to put the enforcement forward. But it's very hard, and it's become a sort of race against the clock, because they have to wait 90 days, and it's very easy to rent for more. And as I said, it's becoming a business. So when we were having a look at it, there were people that were renting, listing more than 200 flats in London. So with all those the complaints of local authorities, Airbnb decided to help, at least officially. They decided to automatically delist the properties that were rented out for more than 90 days. But for what the enforcement officer told us, is not really in place, so they don't even know if Airbnb is actually doing it. Or alternatively, people just found a way to evade it, shifting platforms of changing the description of their listing. So self-regulation is not helping at all this process. And through our interviews, we realized that planning officers were feel generally powerless, and there was a shared feeling of impotence and a frustration that is actually compromising their job satisfaction. And moreover, they are constantly facing with the rage of residents and dissatisfaction with employment, due also to the fact that those people are, that the residents think that the operators have the power to contain the problem. So we realized that this is actually, the regulation is affecting the relationship between planners and residents and the trust that people have on planning as an activity. And so in our current project, we'd like to look at how the regulation impacts on perception of trust in the planning system and how planners view the position, their position as regulators. And we notice and we believe that there is a real danger of the public losing faith in local regulatory systems, and it's going to be very hard to rebuild that. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Hello, my name is Gary Battle and I've worked in the planning and enforcement section at Planning House for 20 years. In enforcement, you see the problem side of planning, and you hear from residents and witness first hand how the planning system does impact on people. In my personal experience, to answer this question, how has deregulation impacted on planning? I think you do have to look at two recent changes. The changes to the general permit development order that allows office to residential conversion without express planning permission, and the Deregulation Act 2015 that made it possible to let your property in London as a short-term holiday let for up to 90 days in any calendar year. Personally, in my experience, these have had a significant and often detrimental effect on neighbourhoods. So firstly, the PD rights. Camden is a borough with high house prices. The difference in income between, an office and a residential is fairly high. And this has been a gift to developers for the last few years. They've just been made able to make money out of the fist, as far as I can see. And it's resulted in the loss of much, especially in Camden, of the smaller scale office and light industrial accommodation. For example, between 2005 and 2012, in the area outside the central activity zone in Camden, we experienced a reduction in the space of B1 space of approximately 3,200 metres a year. This has increased to 42,300. In the years 2013-2014. And also the type of B1 spot lost, not the larger expensive type, but the smaller space suitable for small businesses. And in a place like Camden, which is known for a bit of vibrancy in the creative sector, this is it harder because they usually require smaller accommodation. The type of accommodation provided, in my experience, is nearly always studios or one-bed flats. I don't think I've ever seen family accommodation provided by this prior approval. Or indeed properties for sale, they always appear just for rental. Very often the accommodation created is used for short-term holiday lets. And this means that a local neighbourhood has to deal with the loss of local employment and small business space and an increase in transient holiday making, with nothing to mitigate the problems this creates. Also, they have to pay SIL when they use a prior approval method, but they don't have to pay the Section 106 contributions to open space and other things that we usually ask for. Also, I found that as small businesses leave an area to be replaced with residential, it makes it more difficult for other businesses in the area to operate. Often noise and nuisance from the business was not an issue until residential neighbours moved in. Although office to resi PD rights has changed neighbours from more diverse uses to residential, we receive relatively few complaints about these in the office. But we receive lots of complaints about short-term holiday lets. Before the Deregulation Act, we hardly had any complaints every year, less than a handful. Now we receive on average 100. These internet-based platforms offering short-term holiday lets have really taken off in London since 2015. And we find it a serious problem because many of the properties were purchased as investments and used solely as short-term holiday lets by foreign buyers. It reduces the housing stock for long-term residents and erodes the social cohesion of residential areas. As has been already mentioned, it is difficult to take action against a material change of use and should come on the way back. Because the 90-day limit and complaints about the antisocial behaviour from neighbouring tenants are difficult to tackle with the lack of information provided and the transient nature of guests and absent property owners. Certainly in the south of our borough, south of the Euston Road, local amenity groups complain regularly about how they increase or short-term holiday lets harm the neighbourhood. keeping a balance from having established residential communities and more transient communities. In my mind, this is the greatest impact deregularisation has had on neighbourhoods, the loss of permanent residential accommodation and its use as short-term holiday units. In areas that are attractive to tourists, like the Central Activity Zone, this must be in the thousands. This has obviously impacted the ability of local residents living in an area because of the increased rental income, short-term holiday acts, push up longer rental, and increased, must be the same for a house box. My experience, I've hardly found any instances where homes have been let out while the owners are on holiday. Rather, it always appears to be absent landlords, just operating as a short-term holiday let, or operating as, there's one between longer-term tenants. You know, often when students go home for the holidays, they rent it out as short-term holiday lets. A major part of the Deregulation Act was that it offered no real way to enforce a 90-day limit. Without a registration scheme where properties wanting to operate as short-term holiday lets need to register with the council and need to publish this registration number on the advert, it's very difficult to police effectively. Generally, the public does not realise that just because a property is in use as a short-term holiday let, it's allowed to do this for 90 days a year. But a lot of people just think that because they've found out being used and that we can take action, and obviously we can't. We have to ask neighbours to fill out logs of the daily comings and going, but we have started tested a new tracking software that to help us establish whether it's exceeded 90 days or not. This evidence with the stuff from the residents and visits to the property has allowed us to start issuing a number of enforcement notices against short-term holiday lets. However, these have not been tested on appeal yet. We have got some data from our computer. This shows you, this is apparently one day, June the 12th. Total apartments 7,000. Some of these might be doubled up, but I know there was 4,000 apartments just in Camden advertised on that one day. I think we've only got about 40,000 different apartments in the borough. And you see from the beds. The total revenue is actually from January, and it's calculated on the number of beds and the average income per bed. We've also got a map that shows you the proliferation of the city. This is the borough. This is the south of the borough. This is Euston Road here. As you can see, it's very high density here. And like I say, the amount of short-term holiday lets is really getting to critical levels of.
That's it. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Nancy, for the invitation. So I'm Ben Clifford from UCL, and we completed a study looking particularly at office-to-residential committed development last year. It was published by RICS. It's available online and has some nice pictures. So in this, we started to look at the issue of office-to-residential committed development in England from a few angles, but from 2013, you can convert an office building to residential use without requiring planning permission. You go through a deregulated process called prior approval, whereas before 2013, ever since 1948, you would have needed planning permission for that change of use. So we looked at this through five case study boroughs, one of which was Camden, also Croydon, Reading, Leeds, and Leicester. And we visited... got the lists of all of the schemes that have gone through in those five boroughs in the first 4 years of this deregulation and visited every building, plus a sample of schemes that have gone through full planning permission as comparators. And so we went to 568 buildings, which kept us busy for a few months. And I suppose the short conclusion for me would be regulation shouldn't be a dirty word. We seem to be obsessed with deregulation as a government approach to planning, but actually regulation here can enforce some basic standards that I think we should have around change of use. So we looked at national space standards. The government has recommended space standards that are adopted into planning policy by some authorities. So for example, a studio flat should be 37 metres squared. And we found that only 30% of these permitted development units met those national space standards, compared to 94% that went through planning permission. And some were considerably less. So we found units that were 15 metres squared. That's a studio flat. That's your whole life, apparently. That's the bathroom, the food preparation area, the sleeping area, and a sort of small travelodge type hotel room. We looked at amenity space, so often now councils are looking for things like balconies or roof terraces to ensure good quality of life where you have flats, and only 14% of the units who permitted development had any of this, because this is usually required as part of the planning negotiations. We then looked at the size of apartments, and as Gary's alluded to, they were predominantly studio and one bed. There were 77% studio and one bed, compared to 37% of the conversions that have gone through planning permission routes. And that's a problem, because I don't think the housing need is 77% of people who are basically single professionals. So we then spoke to residents, and indeed you end up with residential overcrowding in these small conversions. They don't have to pay any Section 106 money, because that's done through planning permission negotiations. So for five authorities we looked at, that's about £10 million we calculated they'd lost over 4 years. Not providing affordable units, so that was about 1,600 affordable units. Lost, particularly in Croydon, which has a lot of large conversions. So it's had 3,000 units created through conversions over 4 years. And just as the sort of icing on the cake, the fee income for a planning permission is quite considerable. The fee income for a prior approval is tiny, it was £80. No matter how many units you have, the planning permission fee goes up depending on units, but you could have 100 units in a big office building and you'd be paying £80 to the authority. And although the authority has less work than a planning permission, they still have some work to do around that in a very tight time limit. So those authorities have lost out on about £4 million worth of fee income at a time of great austerity. So, you know, there's a lot of detrimental impacts in terms of finances, in terms of the quality of housing being seen through this. The government said, well, it's boosted housing supply and we have a housing crisis. But I think the housing crisis isn't just about numbers being supplied. I also think when we look at the figures of change of use, it's gone up from about 12,000 in 2010 across England to 37,000 last year. But if we looked back to 2005, it was 20,000 in England. So some of the increase, I think, would have happened anyway as we moved on from the financial crash. Some of it is a diversion of developer and investor income. So if we look at Leeds, from 2013 to 2017, there were actually fewer new build flats built in Leeds than 4 years before this deregulation, because people have moved their attention from new build to conversions. So another good chunk of that supposed uplift is just diversion. And then there's a question about whether it's necessary. We went to the Netherlands to do the comparison, and we found they'd had a big uplift in conversions, not through deregulation, but through a softer governance approach. Many developers are quite conservative, small C. They tend to just do what they've done before. So you can convince them to get into conversions by making it vastly profitable through deregulation, which is what we've done in the UK. Or you can work with them about proactively encouraging them through this route, meeting housing association chief executives in the Netherlands, getting local authorities to proactively do a spatial vision saying which areas or which office buildings they'd like to be converted, having planners proactively work with them to get schemes through a sort of proper development management approach. So what are the impacts? Less affordable housing through this, a loss of infrastructure to support. The government on their impact assessment said there's no difference in the infrastructure requirements for an office building to residential use, so this doesn't matter. I disagree. I think on some things like transport it's fairly similar, but particularly on social infrastructure, it's very different. On green space, on play space for children, it's very different. And to expect local authorities to be able to afford that for hundreds, if not, in the case of Croydon, thousands of new units, I think is a big ask at the moment in austerity. There's a loss of employment space. Gary already mentioned that. There's no requirement the offices are vacant before they're converted. I think converting vacant office space to residential is in principle a great idea, but there's no requirement. And because of the differential in office and residential values, there were plenty of examples of occupied office space or partially occupied office space being converted. Often the sort of cheaper office space, the secondary office space that start-up businesses, creative industries, and things like that need. So there's a very real loss of employment space. There's the impacts on poor quality housing. I think that affects the sort of sense of community. As Gary's mentioned, I think it can lead to antisocial behaviour problems. We heard of one blocking in Croydon, for example. It's so poor quality, it's really hard to rent the units. So the resident there was saying that there's a constant stream of tenants changing because no one wants to stay there. There's a brothel, or she alleged there was a brothel opposite of her, and things like that. There's also, I think, an issue to do with people's sense of well-being and even mental health from living in overcrowded conditions. There's the safety impact. So these conversions are meant to comply with building regulations. I wouldn't say they have to comply with building regulations, the same as planning permission. But there's the difficulties in monitoring them. So the government gave no guidance to local authorities on how you manage a prior approval process. So some put conditions and said, you know, you've got to notify us when you start and finish these works, like you would with the planning permission, and you've got to comply with the plans you submitted. Other authorities didn't do that at all, didn't even know you could do that. So we saw plenty of conversions where what's there is nothing like the plans. The very first one we went to, the small-scale conversion, but we had the plans in front of us. It said four units. As it happened, the landlord was there, came out to know what we, asked what we were doing, had clipboards outside of the building, and we said we're doing a study, and he said, this is great, I've converted this, I've got six units in here. There were many, many examples where the number of units just didn't seem to add up. And you're relying in building control, of course, on approved building control inspectors, so it might not involve the local authority at all. So I just have concerns about the safety of some conversions. There's the loss of democratic control, and the place role for local authorities. I think it undermines local plans, their ability to have a spatial vision, their ability to place shape. If a good chunk of what's been created in terms of new residential units, they have so little control on. And a few local authorities in Sutton, it was 3 years ago, they had more units created through permitted development than new build for that year. So a big chunk of their new housing supply is coming through this deregulated route. And I think we should be greatly concerned.
Thank you. All right, so we have time now to kind of open it up to the audience and try to discuss this question as well from your perspective. I think there are a number of interesting issues that have been raised in terms of how deregulation might change and reshape neighbourhoods, from the idea of short-term letting becoming more prolific and maybe becoming more of a business, and that impacting on neighbourhoods and housing, to the idea that often the permitted development rights might either hit smaller business sites, create flats that aren't necessarily what we would want to see, and all of this also causes a lot more cost to happen in terms of enforcement. It costs much more to have enforcement on short-term letting now, where you have to actually go out in the field and try to collect this data and try to get new computer software in order to do it. And also the enforcement side of building regulations costs more in terms of the permitted development rights and trying to chase this up. So if I could open up to the floor, that would be great.
I have a question for Ben, right? How many, you've got these stats, and mostly I agree with everything, right, but the schemes that were implemented, right, they would be substandard, but what I find, I work at Camden, by the way, with Gary, what I find is that they use the scheme that they've got consent for under the prior approval scheme as a fallback position, so you get something that meets the standards. Right, so where they wouldn't get planning permission to convert the office block, they would have a fallback position to argue for a consent for a scheme that would meet the standards. I mean, has that, you know, played into your stats?
Yeah, when we looked at the implementation rates of the actual prior approvals for the community development, and it did vary slightly between authorities. Nationally, it was 70%. So 70% of the permitted developments have been implemented under the permitted development. Sometimes it was used as a bit of a negotiating tool, but often they did actually just implement the scheme. There was a bit of geographical diversity though. Camden actually had the highest quality coming through, and Camden was a place where you did see that more than other authorities. Places like Leeds and Leicester, they often just did what the prior approval said. Croydon similarly. Croydon a little bit because they introduced an Article 4 direction, which means you actually take away the permitted development as a local authority. They're able to do that in the town centre. And that put a deadline for conversions, so lots of developers actually just rushed through with the conversions that they've got permission for. Sometimes you had office buildings where different floors were in different uses, so some floors were offices and could be converted under prior approval, and other floors would be things like a higher education institute that you couldn't, and so they'd have to go for planning permission. But what we'd often see there is the developers would do different things on different floors of the building, so where they did need planning permission, they would give bigger space standards, but they'd still do the really poor ones on the other floors.
Yeah.
I
have
to put Alessandro, I just wondering, if you're looking into Airbnb, do you also come across, do you also look if people own those properties outright or they have a bank loan? Because with the banks, only very few banks gives a loan that allows somebody to rent out their property on Airbnb.
It's impossible to know. Because it's for the same reason that they can't enforce, it's actually absolutely impossible to know which specific properties are being let out, so you don't know anything about the ownership. A lot of these are also mediated by kind of a mediator in between all of this. So I remember when we were first starting to look at some scraped data that came out of inside Airbnb, we would look at different kind of super hosts. And actually on the platform as well. And there was one girl called Petra who had 250 properties across London. Probably, arguably, not all Petra's properties. Probably that was a kind of a middleman in order to kind of arrange this. But you're right, a lot of mortgages won't allow that, but you have to be caught.
Yeah.
And that's the big point. Except for my dissertation student over here who's found a scheme in the US where they actually encourage you to buy your flat and rent out part of it on Airbnb. And that was the original scheme on their mortgages, which was fascinating and frightening.
I just want to say, if we do have a case where we're litigating it, we usually do write to the bank, if that comes back on the land registry document, and we do planning contravention notice, we do inform them that we could use it.
Jeremy Edge, do you find that with Airbnb lettings there's a resistance in purpose-built modern flats where a landlord or a property developer has developed perhaps maybe a block of 100 flats or whatever it might be, and then sells off long leaseholds to investors and owners, and then perhaps if one of those long leasehold owners decides to let on an Airbnb basis, I think you might find that quite a lot of the residents object to this, and they object because there's a huge service charge impact, because people are coming and going, and the concierge is distracted by Airbnb people who come down for fresh towels and all sorts of other things that you know, they treat it as a hotel. And those long leases normally prohibit short-term lettings. That's the key point. And I would have thought that it would be fairly easy to track that and control Airbnb in those modern developments.
That may be more for you on the more modern developments in terms of being able to control them more easily.
We've come across that, but very often you find that very often the person with the lease doesn't even know what's happening in the property. It may have changed hands a couple of times since then. Someone will rent a property and then they will start advertising it on Airbnb. Sometimes it's all a fraud and they never actually pay and they advertise it abroad. You get some properties that someone has rented, you know, apparently it's for him to live there with his family. And if they're renting it out, they put multiple beds in the rooms, bunk beds, maybe six beds, and they'll use it like a little hostel for 6 months.
That wasn't really my point. The point is really one of equity in terms of the other owners of flats in that block. They are being burdened by the different cost of the Airbnb.
We can't take planning action on that, but certainly they could take action under the lease.
That's really my point. Is that a moderating factor in terms of the proliferation of Airbnb use?
One of the cases I do know about more on that line are generally older mansion blocks, so not in the same kind of vein that you're talking about a new development, but where there have been residents within that building who have complained, and they've tried to kind of keep the evidence that would need to be kept, and with the best will in the world worked with the planners, but eventually realized that nothing was going to happen, and some of those then eventually give up and let out on Airbnb as well. So there are a number of cases in places like Covent Garden where entire buildings have just started going, you know, one flat, then two flats, and then the whole building, because actually the idea of living there is just too uncomfortable.
There was also some whispers there at the beginning, there were a lot of ghosts here that were actually alive, and they were helping and allowing the enforcement officer to get in and help them to identify the flats. But then they slowly see this changing, so they started denying what they were saying at the beginning, so probably the majority of the people started to get started.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I have one question that might actually be a wrong lead, but what you said, Ben, regarding the office to residential conversion, you stated the fact that a lot of the new residential spaces are small studios, like apartment flats, and this seems like the perfect type of apartments that tourists would rent on Airbnb. So to what extent this type of redevelopment is driven not so much by the desire to cater to young working professionals, but rather to tourists who come to London for the weekend?
Yeah, we didn't try and quantify that, but we did have a look when we had case study buildings just to see if we could see anything about them being rented, sold, whatever you could find out just through general internet searches. So we found, particularly in Leeds and Leicester, a lot had gone to student accommodation. I think because of the nature of the market there, and a lot in London had indeed gone to short-term rental. Airbnb or various other similar kind of short-term apartment rentals were very common on office residences.
Can I ask
this
also, your route then was through complaints, that was your route in to then, that then triggered the enforcement? Because the other flip side is obviously you've got the 2004 Housing Act, which kind of introduced this, is it Housing Health and Safety Rating System, which obviously they've got certain standards in which, you know, there is a way to kind of enforce against that as well. So that gives local authorities powers to then knock on, you know, private sector's doors, be it kind of from a private rental sector, to then check to see if their accommodation is up to scratch, and I think there's certain set criteria as well.
So yeah, that's a checklist, isn't there? But short-term holiday lets aren't usually licensed the same way that a lot of the accommodation we talk about is licensed. This is why we think, personally, I think it should be licensed, because I can't see how it's any difference.
No,
in a HMO room, and why you shouldn't be checked for the fire safety and everything else. But because it's an owner-occupied usual, that's how it appears.
So I've got another quick kind of comment to make. I think thinking from your perspective, so looking at the themes, it seems to be like private sector rent, low quality accommodation, the fact about the units being small, it's about affordability, it's about overcrowding, then about poor space standards. Can I ask, so what would your thoughts be like towards purpose-built, maybe, accommodation, be it kind of a co-living product? Would that be something that you would be more encouraging towards?
Possibly. That does come up. That, I think, is by design, and that's where I think you can have a debate about that, and you can look at what provision there might be for say, communal spaces and different kinds of sort of amenity space that's available to residents. So some of those have been permitted through the planning system. The other difference is often the quality. If you do a slightly smaller unit, but it's done at really high quality, with very careful thought about things like storage space, it's not necessarily so bad. But what's happening with the permitted development is there isn't that sort of discussion, there isn't that negotiation, so you're not taking a holistic view of the project. In terms of your earlier point, I mean, there is obviously the housing enforcement route to a lot of this. A lot of that depends on the local authority knowing, which they often have quite constrained capacity to proactively monitor. And a lot of people don't complain. We found that particularly when you have sort of transient communities or in some places immigrant communities are perhaps less familiar with sort of enforcement, there's less willingness to complain or a concern that if you can complain the landlord might find out. So there were those concerns. There's also actually a number of conversions that are used by local authorities themselves for temporary accommodation.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So that was quite common too.
Yeah, sure.
So two things go for that really. One is around I saw the merger sponsor scheme to buy office and industrial space to use to rent back to sort of creative small businesses, that sort of thing. And I wondered if there was any councils that you saw that are perhaps borrowing from the public works rentals to buy office space to try and limit the amount of private conversions that are being done under the PDR, and whether if there's not, that that's a route. And the other thing is around whether there's any like public health levers to kind of stop, to limit the development.
I didn't come across any councils that were renting office space. We did come across some things like business improvement districts, so Camden Town Unlimited, for example, and there were a number of others that were trying to have affordable workspace and provide that themselves. I mean, I thought it was interesting that those sort of business improvement districts in the Croydon Town Centre did the same, were completely opposed to permitted development, so they didn't see it as good for business. And then sort of the public health side of it, Gary.
How you can stop sort of these office conversions?
Yeah, if there's anyone going to need to...
Well, there is the normal process, the Article 4. And Camden has just applied for one for essentially recreational zone, which the law, it originally wasn't in part of the legislation when it first came out. Central activity zones, the central area of London, and part of it, but now it is. But they seem, central government seem to be allowing Article 4 to be part. So it will be, it will have a protection. It'd be very difficult to get an Article 4 though for other parts of the borough. You know, Camden has tried, and I believe other London boroughs have tried.
Islington tried very hard and was just.
Islington and Chelsea have got one.
They got a whole borough. So, an Article 4 from. Because you guys are not from here. Article 4 basically is a planning tool that you can use to exempt certain areas of the city from certain things like permitted development rights. So, Kensington and Chelsea had the whole borough. Camden, you had the central activity zone, and Islington tried, but the government said
no. We tried to get a government in Camden Town as well, didn't we? Protect some of their creative industry, but they weren't having any of it. I know our housing team is very active, especially as it gets a lot of revenue back from fines. We work closely with them, but I don't think we have come any way to to tackle short-term holiday nets or these types in general. Yeah, actually, the standards for environmental health are actually quite low for houses in multiple occupation and that type of thing. So they work to a different level to planners with a higher.
It's also important to know that the UK planning system, in terms of enforcement, we're reactive rather than proactive, basically because of the way it's set up. There are not enough people to be truly proactive. So you rely on complaints, or you rely on kind of eyes on the street in order to be able to figure out what to make enforcement action on. Something like internal quality in terms of health and safety is behind a door. And so it's really difficult to actually notice that. So some of the other illegal informal housing that you see, you know, all of the news that we had about beds in sheds, so where you had that down the back of your garden and you had a family of 15 living in your shed, that's very easy to spot. It's easier to spot. So enforcement against that may happen a little more frequently than in, say, Hackney, where you've got a house that's been divided up into loads of tiny little rooms that would also be illegal. But because there's a, you know, a wall and in front of you, when you go and try to look, you can't necessarily see as easily as there being a shed in the back garden with people clearly coming in and out of it. So it's all of those sorts of intricacies that make the system very difficult to enforce. And then if you add on top of that the fact that with a short-term let, it's almost very, very difficult to enforce that because you've got to try to keep a level of evidence that 90 nights has been breached. That's, you know, that's adding another layer of difficulty to that system. Yeah? And then?
I wonder where you could comment on how this issue is solved in other cities with a dynamic short-term let market, which I would imagine like New York, Amsterdam. We also have their limitation and regulation on what can be rented out as Airbnb, for example. What do they do to actually enforce it? What are the differences there?
Berlin has gone for huge fines and quite a large ban. New York has managed to get data out of Airbnb, but a lot of cities, which you see now, are going into kind of partnerships in terms of a type of self-regulation. So Airbnb doesn't want to be seen as the bad guy in this. And you have to remember there are lots of platforms, not just Airbnb. But for example, with London, they came in with this idea of a partial self-regulation, where they said, okay, we understand there's a problem, we will delist anyone who is breaching the 90-night limit. That doesn't necessarily solve the problem of me just going to booking.com and putting my flat on that, or putting my flat out on multiple different platforms, because there's no way then for Airbnb to know that I'm over here doing it in different places. There's also, you know, I might change my property description slightly or do that kind of thing, so it can slip through the net as well to Airbnb. But a lot of cities have really tried to take a very proactive kind of tack on enforcement with varying levels of success. But I think the idea of having a register is one of the things that would actually be incredibly useful. So you actually fix the fact that if you have a register and if your property is registered, then you can do this for the 90 nights. But if you aren't registered, for example, they can go in and, if you're doing it for one day, actually serve an enforcement notice. So it needs to be a bit more defined, I would have thought. Would you agree,
then? I would agree. Yeah, that's what we're lobbying for. I know Karen Buck, the MP, had a program members' bill in to introduce the form of registration. The property can undergo some preliminary check from the environmental health, and they'll have a reference number that we can use to check how many times it's been advertised, so we can check through the internet or whatever. And it's a 90 days that we've been advertised or been met for more than 1 day. So that should make that job a lot easier. Whether it goes through, I don't know.
Yeah, Alan Benston from Haringey. I want to ask about PD. It's manifestly inappropriate in the London context of our economy and our housing market. I suppose it kind of varies with Help to Buy and Right to Buy for being a record-breaking, manifestly stupid policy. But how does it play out across the rest of the country? I'm always talking to London Central. Other parts of the country with more failing economies or more struggling in industrial areas were actually doing what the government wanted to achieve, as opposed to London.
No, I mean, I thought it was problematic everywhere. And funny enough, when we went out of London to places like Leeds and Leicester, they go, well, this policy is all very well for London, where there's a massive housing demand, but you don't need it up here. Thank you very much. You just saw the same poor quality. Yes, the loss of affordable houses would be far less in Leeds. They're perhaps lucky to get 5% affordable units on planning permission schemes compared to London. But the problems of housing quality are acute. What you tend to get out of London, for example, in Leeds, is the sort of council and civic society people weren't too bothered. They had some of the city centre that had basically gone to student accommodation. And that wasn't a concern, but what they were very concerned about was industrial locations. You tend to get this much more out of London, where you'd have what was an office building that was actually in an industrial location that's been converted. So we went to two in Leeds, where it's still a functioning industrial location. Your neighbours are factories. The sort of fumes and noises, the complete lack of any green space, children are playing a muddy car park outside a furniture factory. One we went to in Leeds, and just the amenity and quality of life for residents is quite appalling. Sunderland wasn't one of our case studies in this, but I've been doing another piece of research there and talking to planners, and they've only had one big scheme, but this one big scheme was in a completely inappropriate location, and then they talked at length about how they inappropriated it there. One of my master's students this year just gone very nicely criticised me in her dissertation and said I'd only looked at urban areas. For my study, and I should look at rural areas, and have done that, and have looked at some market towns. And again, the quantity was much less, but the quality was still poor. And actually, you had a bigger, arguably, impact from the loss of office space. So, should look to, particularly in some sort of suburban places like Sevenoaks, Reigate, Caterham, those sort of places. Where actually they had such small office supply to begin with that they were feeling the effects of it quite dramatically. So I think the effects can be different in different parts of the country, but I think it's having negative effects everywhere.
Was that market town study published?
It's just a student dissertation, so it's not. I might try and work with her on that.
Can I follow up? So that speaks to one of my questions, actually. I was going to say, are there any studies, or should there be a study about the longer term look at consequences, i.e. pressure on other land uses? You know, so what might be the effects on, you know, as you build out, presumably? That'd be interesting to know. Then just going back to the safety perspective, I mean, you know, you had the disaster, scandal at Grenfell. From a pure safety perspective, I'd have thought some of this raises questions and concerns that ought to be brought to all lawmakers' attention if they have an ounce of space, given other preoccupation. And then my third point was, is the policy due for review? And if not, how could it be?
So the permits of animal rights, when they were introduced in 2013, the government did put in what is 3-year sunset clauses, but they reviewed it in October 2015 and said it's a great success because it's delivering thousands more housing units. Yeah. So they made it permanent, and now they're looking, of course, throughout the budget, extended permitted development, so upward, building more floors on buildings, and even it's floated in there the idea of demolishing and rebuild as a permitted development for residential, which I find quite alarming. In terms of the safety implications, the sort of line you get, because I have been invited to the Ministry to talk about our study, but the line you get from them is, well, building regs have to apply here, and that's it, so they don't see a problem. But for me, it's the problem about the reality of what's happening rather than actually what you're required to. And apologies, what was the first?
Not on consequences, pressure on other land, so
yeah.
Probably harder to track, but very real anyway.
Yeah,
it shows up.
I mean, when we bid for this study, some other upper ends of Sheffield were also willing to do work on community development, and said they thought it was a bit too soon to do the sort of case studies that we did. I don't think it was, and we found what we found. But we have only looked at the sort of first 4 years of a policy, that there definitely is scope for a longer term effect. The British Council for Officers have monitored it, they're obviously very interested in that. And we're still only sort of 5 years in, but they said that in reaction there did seem to be an upswing in applications to build the office space. So the argument you then get is, well, the market's correcting itself. But the problem with that is what you get built is brand new high quality office space, grade A office space, which isn't usually what people are displaced from sort of secondary office space in the end. But to really see those trends, yeah, you would need to do a longer term study, there's definitely need for that.
But part of the problem with that is the problem has already occurred.
Yeah.
So you can't really go backwards in that sense. I mean, it very well needs to be done, but once you've kind of deregulated and once you've allowed that to occur, then you truly have lost those spaces. You've lost those lower quality office spaces that were needed for,
I know you've lost them, but in planning terms, you know, kind of planning's all about planning, isn't it? It's not looking back or then look at trends. It's about saying, well, okay, what do you want to zone land for? What broadly are your policies for where you want stuff to happen? If that's being subverted in certain ways and having, I was going to say domino effect, in a way it is a kind of domino effect, it has a push factor.
Oh, 100%.
Then how do you grasp that when you're sitting in an examination in public, you're trying to respond to a planning policy, you know, the way you write planning policy or responses to it? How do you capture that in a spatial sense and talk about the knock-on effects for other types of land use, other types of amenity? Green space kids don't have enough to run in anyway. You know, so I'd say great if they're running around in a factory yard because at least they're outdoors, but you know, there are limits. So the knock-on consequences in spatial planning terms will show up. So how much can they get anticipated, I suppose?
And it does help construct an argument about why planning is actually potentially important in these things.
Yep.
Because if we are deregulating so much, then part of that is down to the discourse of government who says if we just deregulate, everything will be great. And if you can illustrate that actually there are problems with this deregulation, then you can hopefully change that kind of attitude. But my fear is that it will be too late by the time we do, which was my only thought.
Yeah.
I think you're then left with a quantum of poor housing for years, decades.
Yes.
And once things are converted to housing, it's quite rare for them to change back.
Yeah, and just picking up on that employment point, I think you do have to be kind of forward-looking, because as you say, from you can't, you know, do what's happened in the past, it's kind of gone. But there is one kind of argument needs to be addressed about this, in the sense that if you look particularly at London, I don't know so much about kind of Leeds and Leicester and places like that, but we've had this huge loss of office stock through PDR, but at the same time employment in London has actually kind of zoomed, you know, it's actually kind of really increased massively. So there could, you know, people who favour this policy could argue that, well, you know, there's been a kind of structural change, you don't occupy as much office space as you used to, therefore it's been shaking out what's been, you know, what was redundant or perhaps not suitable, or not perhaps most suited to the actual kind of uses which people are occupying at the present. You can make that argument for quite a short period, but clearly that can't go on forever. So you can say, so the argument you might want to put forward is say, well, okay, you know, PDR has been an instrument for kind of short-term kind of structural shifts of getting rid of these old semi office blocks which were no good to anyone and nobody wanted to occupy them. But you can't continue to kind of keep losing employment space going forward, because, you know, you can't ever keep on going, you know, increasing employment and reducing office space, because those companies don't know how it works for short term, it doesn't go on forever.
Yeah, I think there is an argument you could make there, absolutely. It's some of the big sort of vacant office buildings, which were vacant in Croydon in particular,
it's actually good that they've been put to use because they were life expired big 70s blocks and nobody wants them anymore for employment use because of the changes. But actually, Croydon had a local plan. It was also an opportunity area under the London plan, with an opportunity area planning framework that both said we'd like these blocks to be converted to other uses, particularly residential. And if you look at the rates of planning permission on change of use before the deregulation came in, it was the same as any other type of planning permission. It was 86% for the 4 years before when I looked at it. So why did you need the deregulation? I don't think there was this big mass of councils saying, no, you can't convert this office space. We need every bit of employment land that we've got. I think most councils were realistic in what was worth keeping and what wasn't worth keeping. So it's the evidence of the necessity that I think was lacking.
I agree. It's just that from the argument back there, why should stop here now?
Mm.
And on a related point to that, things do change over time. I remember when the central electricity zone was first introduced, there was actually a big debate as to whether housing should be a central London activity at all. And we had a location of offices where they were trying to move employment out, and also the housing market in central London was being heavily destabilised. But looking further ahead, I wondered whether there's any, whether you found at all any of you involved in this. It seems to me that, given the fact it's about deregulation, the authorities, in terms of granting or withholding, or no longer being able to grant planning permission, they had a kind of, they were arbiters, people who regulated. So, for example, if someone applied for a planning permission to change a use, as a local resident, you could say, I don't like it, and they said, we do like it, and there was this kind of authority which then arbitrated and said, okay, this is the outcome. And by and large, people didn't feel entirely satisfied with that, but at least they felt they had some format with form where they could debate the issue. Now they can't. And I was wondering whether there's an impact within communities, where people are now actually far from trying to build sustainable communities. There's actually much more unrest, and there's likely to be more unrest within the community. People, someone mentioned, I think, in the block in Covent Garden, where people are actually saying, okay, it's too late, we're going to go. Yet another change of the marginalised, people not having the control over their own life.
Well, that's one of the arguments that we're trying to build. I've done some work before on conservation areas and looked at people's reaction to conservation area regulation. And you might think that because it constrains what you can do with your house, that you'd be very anti-conservation area regulation. But for the most part, in a lot of the conservation areas that we actually studied, people were either relatively sanguine or actually quite pro the idea that there was this regulation, that it was relatively fair, that people discussed it, that it might have gone against me a little bit, but I can see why we're trying to keep the integrity of the area. Okay. We find in terms of especially the short-term letting and things like that, people feel much more impotent about things, about the council being able to do anything for them, because they realise they come with this complaint, they have the hope that the council can actually solve the problem. The council says, okay, but we need to collect evidence, let's collect evidence. You turn that person into a policeman almost. And you don't end up with that sense of democracy, that sense of faith. And I think what you very much run the risk of is actually eroding any sort of trust in the community in these sorts of mechanisms, and then that has knock-on effects overall.
In respect of the conservation areas, I think I think the demographics play an important part. You know, the older you are, the more likely you are wanting to preserve the street character.
Sure, but a lot of the people that are also complaining about STL are roughly the same demographic. And on the one side, they complain with because somebody has changed their windows or has painted the outside of the house pink, and the conservation policy can kick in and somebody can do something about it. On the other hand, they find that there's an all-night rave next to them, and you know, everything is ruined and everything is horrible, and they complain and find that nothing happens, or that they can't do anything. And that's that. those are the same kind of people demographically, but one walks away satisfied, if not slightly upset maybe that the planning decision went against them, and the other walks away very dissatisfied because they feel there's nothing that can be done. And that's, I think, a dangerous position to put planning in.
Is there an opportunity for the localism agenda to play a larger part here in terms of neighbourhood planning, which we haven't touched on this evening, but it seemed to me that that would have some prospect of introducing local community control through the planning system if people were prepared to take that up. Is that something you've looked at?
It's not something I've looked at specifically, but I think in these two instances with office to resi and with short-term letting, I don't think the community, even with the best will in the world, would have any ability to effect change on that because it's national regulation. Oh, 1 minute, thank you. Is that 1 minute to make myself shut up?
We're closing.
Okay, all right.
As I understand it, the localism, they can't change those.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Sorry, I didn't look over.
You can, I mean, through a neighbourhood plan, you can increase the amount of permitted development above the national, but you can't go the other way.
So, thank you guys all for coming. Please fill in the little post cards if you wish. We will be retiring to the George. Please do come and have a drink with us because we're planners and that's what we're doing. Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.